Shalom, friends. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Access. This is Timothy, and I'm excited to be studying the scriptures with you today. Let's have a quick recap from our last study. Jacob had tricked his father Isaac into giving him the blessing meant for his slightly older twin brother Esau. Esau was enraged and wanted to kill Jacob, but planned to hold off until their father had passed away. Rebekah knew of Esau's plan, so she devised a plan of her own to protect her favorite son Jacob by sending him away. Isaac and Rebekah sent Jacob to his mother's hometown in Haran, Mesopotamia, to find a wife. He went to his uncle Laban's house, worked for him 14 years in exchange for Laban's two daughters, Leah and Rachel, to be his wives. He had 11 sons and at least one daughter through his two wives and two concubines, Bilhah and Zilpah. He worked another 6 years for the flocks and became very wealthy. There was a lot of deception and manipulation surrounding Jacob's life and his relationships. Now we come to the point of the story in Jacob's life where he is in his 90s and he's ready to begin his own life. Our study today is called Righting Wrongs, and we're continuing the story of Jacob as he's ready to move on from his life in Mesopotamia. If you need a handout for today's Access Learn study, please visit our Facebook group, Connections Ministries of Canada, and you'll find all of our studies under the Files tab. Also visit our website at connectionsministries.com. And if you haven't done so already, please subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss out on any of our studies. As we continue the study through Genesis, I recommend having a Bible handy to follow along. And I encourage you to take some time with your own Access Church communities, small groups and families, and review the study together. Now let's get started, Righting Wrongs. Today, my wife Beverly will be reading from Genesis chapters 31, 32, and 33 from the Complete Jewish Bible.
But then he heard what Laban's sons were saying. Yaakov has taken away everything that our father once had. It's from what used to belong to our father that he has gotten so rich. He also saw that Laban regarded him differently than before. Adonai said to Yaakov, "Return to the land of your ancestors, to your kinsmen. I will be with you." So Yaakov sent for Rachel and Leah and had them come to the field where his flock was. He said to them, "I see by the way your father looks that he feels differently toward me than before. But the God of my father has been with me. You know that I have served your father with all my strength, and that your father has belittled me and has changed my wages 10 times. But God did not allow him to do to me any damage. If he said, 'The speckled will be your wages,' then all the animals gave birth to speckled young. And if he said, 'The streaked will be your wages,' then all the animals gave birth to streaked young. This is how God has taken away your father's animals and given them to me. Once, when the animals were mating, I had a dream. I looked up, and there in front of me the male goats which mated with the females were streaked, speckled, and mottled. Then, in the dream, the angel of God said to me, 'Yaakov,' and I replied, 'Here I am.' He continued, 'Raise your eyes now and look. All the male goats mating with the females are streaked, speckled, and mottled, for I have seen everything Laban has been doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a standing stone with oil, where you vowed your vow to me. Now get up, get out of this land, and return to the land where you were born.' Rachel and Leah answered him, 'We no longer have any inheritance from our father's possessions, and he considers us foreigners, since he has sold us. Moreover, he has consumed everything he received in exchange for us. Nevertheless, the wealth which God has taken away from our father has become ours, and our children's anyway. So whatever God has told you to do, do.' Then Yaakov got up, put his sons and wives on the camels, and carried off all his livestock along with all the riches he had accumulated, the livestock in his possession, which he had acquired in Padam Aram, to go to Yitzhak his father in the land of Canaan. Now Laban had gone to shear his sheep, so Rachel stole the household idols that belonged to her father, and Yaakov outwitted Laban the Arami by not telling him of his intended flight. So he fled with everything he had, he departed, crossed the Euphrates River, and set out for the hill country of Gilead. Not until the third day was Laban told that Yaakov had fled. Laban took his kinsmen with him and spent the next 7 days pursuing Yaakov, overtaking him in the hill country of Gilead. But God came to Laban the Arami in a dream that night and said to him, "Be careful that you don't say anything to Yaakov, either good or bad." When Laban caught up with Yaakov, Yaakov had set up camp in the hill country. So Laban and his kinsmen set up camp in the hill country of Gilead. Laban said to Yaakov, "What do you mean by deceiving me and carrying off my daughters as if they were captives taken in war? Why did you flee in secret and deceive me and not tell me? I would have sent you off with joy and singing to the music of tambourines and lyres. You didn't even let me kiss my sons and daughters goodbye. What a stupid thing to do. I have it in my power to do you harm. But the god of your father spoke to me last night and said, be careful that you don't say anything to Yaakov, either good or bad. Granted that you had to leave, because you longed so deeply for your father's house, but why did you steal my gods? Yaakov answered Laban, because I was afraid. I said, suppose you take your daughters away from me by force. But if you find your gods with someone, that person will not remain alive. So with our kinsmen to witness, if you spot anything that I have which belongs to you, take it back. Yaakov did not know that Rahel had stolen them. Laban went into Yaakov's tent, then into Leah's tent, and into the tent of the two slave girls, but he did not find them. He left Leah's tent and entered Rahel's tent. Now Rahel had taken the household gods, put them in the saddle of the camel, and was sitting on them. Laban felt all around the tent, but did not find them. She said to her father, please don't be angry that I'm not getting up in your presence, but it's the time of my period. So he searched, but he didn't find the household gods. Then Yaakov became angry and started arguing with Laban. What have I done wrong? He demanded. What is my offense that you have come after me in hot pursuit? You have felt around in all my stuff, but what have you found of all your household goods? Put it here, in front of my kinsmen and yours, so that they can render judgment between the two of us. I have been with you for these 20 years. Your female sheep and goats haven't aborted their young, and I haven't eaten the male animals in your flocks. If one of your flock was destroyed by a wild animal, I didn't bring the carcass to you, but bore the loss myself. You demanded that I compensate you for any animal stolen, whether by day or by night. Here's how it was for me. During the day, thirst consumed me, and at night, the cold. My sleep fled from my eyes. These 20 years I've been in your house. I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you changed my wages 10 times. If the God of my father, the God of Avraham, the one whom Yitzhak fears, had not been on my side, by now you would certainly have already sent me away with nothing. God has seen how distressed I've been and how hard I've worked, and last night he passed judgment in my favor. Laban answered Yaakov, the daughters are mine, the children are mine, the flocks are mine, and everything you see is mine. But what can I do today about these daughters of mine or the children they have borne? So now, come, let's make a covenant, I and you, and let it stand as a testimony between me and you. Yaakov took a stone and set it upright as a standing stone. Then Yaakov said to his kinsmen, gather some stones. And they took stones, made a pile of them, and ate there by the pile of stones. Laban called it Yagar Sahaduta, pile of witness in Aramaic, while Yaakov called it Galed, pile of witness in Hebrew. Laban said, this pile witnesses between me and you today. This is why it is called Galed, and also Hamitzpah, because he said, may Adonai watch between me and you when we are apart from each other. If you cause pain to my daughters, or if you take wives in addition to my daughters, then even if no one is there with us, still God is witness between me and you. Laban also said to Yaakov, here is this pile, and here is the standing stone which I have set up between me and you. May this pile be a witness, and may the standing stone be a witness, that I will not pass beyond this pile to you, and you will not pass beyond this pile and this standing stone to me, to cause harm. May the God of Avraham, and also the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us. But Yaakov swore by the one his father Yitzhak feared. Yaakov offered a sacrifice on the mountain and invited his kinsmen to the meal. They ate the food and spent the whole night on the mountain. Chapter 32. Early in the morning Laban got up, kissed his sons and daughters, and blessed them. Then Laban left and returned to his own place. Yaakov went on his way, and the angels of God met him. When Yaakov saw them, he said, this is God's camp, and called that place Machanaim. Yaakov sent messengers ahead of him to Esau his brother toward the land of Seir, the country of Edom, with these instructions. Here's what you are to say to my lord Esau. Your servant Yaakov says, I have been living with Laban and have stayed until now. I have cattle, donkeys, and flocks, and male and female servants. I am sending to tell this news to my lord in order to win your favor. The messengers returned to Yaakov, saying, we went to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you. With him are 400 men. Yaakov became greatly afraid and distressed. He divided the people, flocks, cattle, and camels with him into two camps, saying, if Esau comes to the one camp and attacks it, At least the camp that is left will escape. Then Yaakov said, God of my father Avraham, the God of my father Yitzhak, Adonai, who told me, return to your country and your kinsmen, and I will do you good. I am not worthy of all the love and faithfulness you have shown your servant, since I crossed the Jordan with only my staff. But now I have become two camps. Please, rescue me from my brother Esau. I am afraid of him, afraid he'll come and attack me without regard for mothers or children. You said, I will certainly do you good and make your descendants as numerous as the grains of sand by the sea, which are so many they can't be counted. So he stayed there that night. Then he chose from among his possessions the following as a present for Esau, his brother. 200 female goats and 20 males, 200 female sheep and 20 males, 30 milk camels and their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 colts. He turned them over to his servants. Every drove by himself and said to his servants, cross over in front of me and keep a space between each drove and the next one. He instructed the servant in front, when Esau my brother meets you and asks you, whose servant are you, where are you going, and whose animals are these? Then you are to say, they belong to your servant Yaakov. And they are a present he has sent to my lord Esau, and Yaakov himself is just behind us. He also instructed the second servant and the third, and all that followed the droves, when you encounter Esau, you are to speak to him in the same way. And you are to add, and there, just behind us, is your servant Yaakov. For he said, I will appease him first with the present that goes ahead of me. Then, after that, I will see him myself. And maybe he will be friendly toward me. So the present crossed over ahead of him, and he himself stayed that night in the camp. He got up that night, took his two wives, his two slave girls, and his 11 children, and forded the Yabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream, then sent his possessions across, and Yaakov was left alone. Then some man wrestled with him until daybreak. When he saw that he did not defeat Yaakov, he struck Yaakov's hip socket, so that his hip was dislocated while wrestling with him. The man said, let me go, because it's daybreak. But Yaakov replied, I won't let you go unless you bless me. The man asked, what is your name? And he answered, Yaakov. Then the man said, from now on you will no longer be called Yaakov, but Israel, because you have shown your strength to both God and men, and have prevailed. Yaakov asked him, please tell me your name. But he answered, why are you asking about my name? And blessed him there. Yaakov called the place Peniel, because I have seen God face to face, yet my life is spared. As the sun rose upon him, he went on past Peniel, limping at the hip. This is why to this day the people of Israel do not eat the thigh muscle that passes along the hip socket, because the man struck Yaakov's hip at its socket. Chapter 33. Yaakov raised his eyes and looked out, and there was Esau coming, and 400 men with him. So Yaakov divided the children between Leah, Rachel, and the two slave girls, putting the slave girls and their children first, Leah and her children second, and Rachel and Yosef last. Then he himself passed on ahead of them and prostrated himself on the ground 7 times before approaching his brother. Esau ran to meet him, hugged him, threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Esau looked up. On seeing the women and children, he asked, who are these with you? Yaakov answered, the children God has graciously given to your servant. Then the slave girls approached with their children, and they prostrated themselves. Leah too and her children approached and prostrated themselves. And last came Yosef and Rachel, and they prostrated themselves. Esau asked, what was the meaning of this procession of droves I encountered? And he answered, it was to win my lord's favor. Esau replied, I have plenty already, my brother. Keep your possessions for yourself. Yaakov said, no, please, if now I have won your favor, then accept my gift. Just seeing your face has been like seeing the face of God, now that you have received me. So please accept the gift I have brought you, for God has dealt kindly with me, and I have enough. Thus he urged him until he accepted it. Esau said, let's break camp and get going. I'll go first. Yaakov said to him, my lord knows that the children are small, and the sheep and cattle suckling their young concern me, because if they overdrive them even one day, all the flocks will die. Instead, please let my lord go on ahead of his servant. I will travel more slowly, at the pace of the cattle ahead of me, and at the pace of the children, until I come to my lord in Seir. Esau replied, then let me leave you with some of the people I have with me. But Yaakov said, there's no need for my lord to be so kind to me. So Esau left that day to return to Seir. Yaakov went on to Sukkot, where he built himself a house and put up shelters for his cattle. This is why the place is called Sukkot. Having traveled from Padam Aram, Yaakov arrived safely at the city of Shechem in Canaan and set up camp near the city. From the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, he bought for 100 pieces of silver the parcel of land where he had pitched his tent. There he put up an altar, which he called El Elohai Yisrael, God, the God of Israel.
So what do we see happening here at the beginning of chapter 31? Yaakov overhears Laban's sons grumbling about how his wealth should be theirs. Now these guys are just as jealous and selfish and greedy as their father Laban was. So Yaakov takes this as his cue to finally leave. He had been working for Laban for 20 years and it was time for him to finally move on. Of course, that was his decision by wanting to escape the drama and manipulation that he had endured for so long. Now, here we have Yaakov, a man without a country. I mean, did he belong to Mesopotamia or to Canaan? Remember, he fled Canaan as a means of survival to escape his brother's plot to kill him. Now, eventually, Yaakov would lead his family to Egypt as a means for survival again. But for now, Canaan was probably the only place he could kind of call home. So where else would he go if he were to uproot his family from Mesopotamia? Well, it's a good thing that Yehovah God instructed Yaakov that now was the time that he would fulfill his promise to bring him back to his home, Canaan. And what do we see Yaakov do immediately after receiving God's instructions? Well, he consults his wives, Leah and Rachel. I mean, why would he consult them? Why didn't he just listen to God and lead his family? I mean, some people might judge him and say that he wasn't leading. Well, certainly, Hebrew society was male-dominated, right? However, it should be noted that Hebrew society also greatly revered women. And we catch a glimpse of that here as Yaakov consults his wives immediately after hearing from God. See, he was considering their feelings, and he valued their thoughts. He included his wives in the decision that would affect them greatly, to leave their family forever. Leah and Rachel were ready to leave. Like we see in verse 14, it says, Rachel and Leah answered him, "We no longer have any inheritance from our father's possessions, and he considers us foreigners, since he has sold us. Moreover, he has consumed everything he received in exchange for us. Nevertheless, the wealth which God had taken away from our father has become ours, and our children's anyway. So whatever God has told you to do, just do it." Wow, you could see how Laban did a really great job raising his kids, right? First we have his grumbling sons, and now you have his bitter daughters. Like, there was nothing left that their father could give them. He had no intention of caring for them, and they were satisfied to just take what they could get from whatever God had dealt them. It's kind of a theme for their family: greedy, selfish, and jealous. Well, Yaakov wasted no time. He quickly and quietly packs up his family, his livestock, his riches. He's essentially packing the van for a long journey back to Canaan. And Laban has no idea that they're about to flee. And in verse 19, we see Rachel, the wife, go back and grab some last-minute things. But what she takes, it's not hers. We're told that she steals the household gods, her father's idols. Dun dun dun. That can't be good. You see, in Mesopotamia, it was the tradition that whoever possessed the family gods was the owner of the family wealth and authority, much like the Bekor with the firstborn blessing, the Beracha. So why did Rachel steal the household gods? Well, she would have had every intention to keep these idols until Laban was in his grave. And at that point, she would appear before the family with these idols, and she would have assured a family inheritance for herself. So this wasn't just like petty theft. This was like a serious deal. They actually believed in these gods, and they prayed to them for rain and protection and healing and children. It's no wonder that Laban went to such great lengths in search of his gods. And just as he was gearing up all his men to go in hot pursuit for Yaakov and his clan, we see something interesting happen in verse 24. God, Yehovah God, came to Laban in a dream and warned him not to speak either good or bad to Yaakov. Why is this significant? Have you ever stopped to consider that God speaks to non-believers too? This is the first instance in all of Scripture where God speaks to a pagan. Remember, Laban was a pagan that believed in many gods, so to acknowledge Yaakov's God as another god, it wasn't such a big deal for him. And in the past, we've kind of seen how Laban would use Yehovah God's name to kind of influence Yaakov to stay a little longer. He'd use it to manipulate him. By invoking Yehovah God's name whenever he was speaking to Yaakov, it fulfills Laban's selfish purposes by keeping Yaakov around. But the point here is that God could speak to whoever he chooses, right? Not only to believers, he'll speak to non-believers too. And just because a person acknowledges God doesn't make them a believer either. So Laban and his posse finally catch up to Yaakov and his clan at the northern part of Canaan in an area called Gilead. And when he gets there, he tells this phony sort of lie and says, "Why did you leave in secret?" And he's like scolding Yaakov, "You didn't give me a chance to kiss my sons and my daughters goodbye. I didn't get to throw them a farewell party." Whatever. Whatever, dude. You didn't care about your daughters. You don't care about your grandchildren. Because the next thing that he says, he's asking about, "Where are my household gods?" And he's accusing Yaakov of taking them. Yaakov, at this point, remember, he had no clue that Rachel had taken Laban's gods, the idols. And in verse 32, he actually invites Laban to go search through everywhere, and if he could find them, sure, take your gods. And if anybody was found with those gods, Yaakov pronounced that that person would be executed. Now, I have a personal confession. When I was reading this in the scriptures, I was starting to sweat a little bit. Like, my heart was racing, and I was like, oh no, what's going to happen to Rachel? It's really the making of a really good soap opera, because Rachel was the wife that Yaakov loved the most. And he was pronouncing her death already because he didn't have all the information. But we know that Rachel could hold her own. She's got some tricks up her sleeve, I'm sure. After all, consider the family that she was raised in. Manipulative, conniving, and crafty beyond belief, this family knows how to plot and scheme to their own advantage. When Laban had searched through the camp and came up empty-handed, and he finally comes to Rachel's tent, we see that she hid the idols from her father by sitting on them, and then she excuses herself from not getting up to greet him. Why? Because she was on her monthly cycle. Her period. Now, why didn't Laban just demand that she get up to honor and respect him? Was he really just a sensitive man that cared about her current predicament? Not at all. He knew that if he had come in contact with her or anything that she touched while she was on her cycle, that he would become ritually impure himself. And if he were to find the idols, he wouldn't be able to handle them because of his impurity. That Rachel would intentionally transmit her uncleanness to the gods she was sitting on would have been unthinkable to Laban. So he wouldn't have even thought to look under where she was sitting. Now keep in mind that Yaakov had no idea that Rachel had them. But he was really furious with Laban at his accusation that somebody took the gods. This was the straw that broke the camel's back. Like, Yaakov was done with Laban. There was no way. After 20 years, he was finally going to go off on his own. Now keep in mind, how old was Yaakov at this time? He was in his 90s. He had done his time, and he's just starting his life now. And Laban was older as well, but this proud and greedy Laban had never been able to accept Yaakov's wealth. And threatened by Yaakov's increasing success, Laban cleverly suggests that they make a treaty with one another so that, you know, he said that he wouldn't have to be at war with his daughters, but we know that he's really just protecting himself. So they put up a pile of standing stones as both a testament to their agreement and a sort of boundary marker as well. And of course they have the typical covenant meal to seal the deal. So setting up these standing stones or stone piles or columns as boundary markers, they still do that today, right? And through this passage, it doesn't give the full detail about the covenant procedure, and it doesn't mention a sacrifice, which of course would have been a clean animal cut up in pieces and divided into two piles, and then Yaakov and Laban would walk between the pieces as a sign of agreement. And no covenant was complete without a sworn oath, which was what we read in verse 53. It says, "May the God of Abraham and also the God of Nahor, the God of the father, judge between us." But Yaakov swore by the one his father Yitzhak feared. The scriptures also tell us that they each named the pile of stones, the boundary markers, according to their native language. Yigar Saduta is a form of Chaldean, and Galed is Hebrew, and they both mean a pile of witnesses. So after this covenant of mitzvah was made, they had eaten the food and spent the whole night on the mountain. It says that early in the morning, Laban got up, and it says that he kissed his sons and daughters. Remember, it was only his two daughters and the concubines going with Yaakov, but also all of his grandchildren. Just to clear up any confusion there, it was common terminology to refer to grandchildren as sons in those days. We're here in chapter 32 now. After Laban kisses them and blesses them, he turns around and returns home. As Yaakov goes on his way, we're told that he's met by angels of God. In Hebrew, the Malachim Elohim, plural. These messengers of heaven, what message were they bringing? Well, their appearance was perhaps an assurance that he was back in the promised land in Canaan. Or they were a visible presence, also confirming that God was with him. Remember upon Yaakov's journey leaving Canaan, he had encountered angels at Bethel. And now on his journey of return to Canaan, he encounters angels again. Because of this encounter, he names this place Mahanaim, meaning two camps, his camp and God's camp. After being visited by the Malachim Elohim, Yaakov sends his own Malachim ahead to Esau in hope of a reconciliation. And the messengers come back with good news and bad news. The good news? They found Esau. The bad news? Esau is coming and he has 400 men with him. But why did Yaakov fear Esau? Well, remember, the last that he knew, Esau wanted to kill him after he stole the blessing. And Esau was a wild and untamed man. A hunter, a killer. And Yaakov knew that he had wronged his brother, and he was trying to do everything to appease Esau's wrath with all the gifts of herds and flocks, and he sends them ahead. And he must have been hoping that some time had passed and Esau's angry heart would have been healed. When Yaakov heard that Esau was coming, he ordered that his family be divided into two groups. If Esau exacted his revenge on Yaakov, well, perhaps the other group would still survive. After his encounter with the Malachim Elohim, and he names this place Mahanaim, meaning two camps, what we see him doing here, he's actually dividing his family into two camps. So this just affirms the name of the place, Mahanaim, two camps. Now imagine Yaakov facing all the deceit and guilt in his life, which was now manifesting itself in this seemingly impossible situation. He couldn't weasel his way out of this one. The only thing left for him to do was something that we hadn't seen him do very much of in his 97 years of life. He falls on his knees before God and he prays. It was only a matter of time and experiencing God's grace that could change Yaakov. He knew that he didn't deserve any of the wondrous bounty and protection that Yehovah had provided for him. Now let's be honest. How often have we experienced something like this, where we grow impatient waiting on God, or we drag our behinds and dilly-dally when he's pointing us and prodding us to move, or perhaps we simply rebel and just do wrong, and then we find ourselves in a prison of our own making? We eventually turn to God and ask him to rescue us from the natural consequences of our sin. Well, Yaakov's life from the womb until now had been riddled with this sort of struggle and striving, and it appears that he inherited his mother's crafty ways and was able to wiggle and manipulate and deceive to get whatever he wanted. But cheats and liars eventually get found out, right? And even if you do a good job hiding from people, you know that you can't truly hide from yourself or from God. So, you see, this sort of silent and internal struggling is probably one of the heaviest burdens to carry, isn't it? Until we're able to right our wrongs. All right, let's get back to the story. And here we're looking at the wrestling match, right? Who was Yaakov wrestling with? In verse 25, it says that he wrestled with an ish, a man. In verse 29 and 31, it's clearly a divine being in the form of a man. And we see that Yaakov didn't give up in the wrestling match, even after having his hip dislocated by the simple touch from this divine man being. And Yaakov refused to give up until he was blessed. Now, what's so significant about this detail of Yaakov's dislocated hip? At some point in our lives, we all wrestle with God. Our human nature is a stubborn one with a will of our own. And it's only when we make that willful choice through absolute surrender that we leave our tattered history behind and start on this new history with Yehovah God as the Lord of our lives. And just because we choose to submit to God, it doesn't mean that we won't carry the scars of our past. And we'll always have to deal with them. Sometimes, like Yaakov, we pay a price to leave behind our rebellious ways and move forward into the new life. Here for Yaakov, it was inheriting this permanent disability as he crossed over from a foreign place and into the promised land. For us, it's true that we are spiritually forgiven when we believe, right? But the natural consequences of sin, they don't end. This is something that we see with Yaakov. He would walk with a limp all the remaining days of his life, and this would also serve as a testament and a constant reminder of having fought with God for almost 100 years until he finally submitted, instead of attempting to make a deal with God where he still gets to hold on to power of his own life. And why did this divine man-being ask a seemingly strange question in the midst of the fight? He says, "What's your name?" He replies, "Yaakov." Well, the name Yaakov in Hebrew, remember, it means, "May God be your defending rear guard." So here, God now adds a name to Yaakov's given name for further blessing, Israel. It indicates someone who has successfully struggled with God. And both names are used interchangeably hereafter. His additional name, Israel, is consistent with his inheriting the covenant promises, as he had to step into the family's leadership role. His new name also means one who is a prince with God. Friends, a lesson that I learned here is that when we fight with God, you can be sure that there's absolutely no chance of victory on our terms. But our victory in God, it only comes through the defeat of ourselves. And this is exactly what happens when every believer who surrenders their will to Yehovah's. At the end of chapter 32, there's this detail of the sun rising on Yaakov as he went on past Peniel, limping at the hip. It's a new day, and he had seen the face of God and his life was spared. He moves on with this new sense of purpose, with a new name describing his new nature, and also this limp that reminds him of his encounter with God. And this was the exact day when the nation of Israel was established. And here we are at chapter 33. In this new day, Yaakov looks up and he sees Esau approaching with his 400 men. Yaakov places his family in a special order with his concubines and their children up front, and then Leah and her children second, and then he kept his beloved Rachel and his favorite son Yosef at the rear. And this was the moment of truth. Would Yaakov and his family line survive this encounter with Esau? The entire future of his family was on the line here. Yaakov goes ahead of his clan to meet his twin brother first, and he prostrated himself on the ground 7 times before approaching his brother. Esau would have been like the king of this territory in the absence of Yaakov these past 20 years. Now let's look closer at verse 4. we get this beautiful picture of these two brothers. Esau ran to meet him. He hugged him, threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Esau had forgiven Yaakov and offers a gracious, loving reception, and Yaakov's fears are dispelled. And it seems that some wrongs were made right. The years had softened Esau's anger, just as their mother Rivka had said. And all the generous gift-giving from Yaakov, it expressed his sincere repentance with all the wrongdoings against his brother. When I read this passage, it just seemed that there was a lot of goodwill spewing from both brothers toward one another. But what's actually going on here is that we see them performing that customary cultural dance of Esau refusing the initial gift, and Yaakov insisting that he accept them, and then eventually Esau accepts. It's just how it's always done, and it is a way of respect as well. And here we also catch a glimpse of Yaakov's cunning ways as he leads Esau to believe that his clan would come and join him in his land of Edom. And as soon as Esau leaves to return home, we see Yaakov makes his way back northwest near to the place where the wrestling match occurred. And he stayed there for a couple of years, and he names this place Sukkot, meaning booths or huts, because he built temporary shelters there for his family and his animals, as this is not where they were settling. Eventually, Yaakov moves to Shechem, the very same place his grandfather Abraham had come through when he first entered Canaan. When Yaakov arrived in Shechem, he discovered a walled city had been built there, and the land was named after one of King Hamor's sons, Shechem. Yaakov purchases a parcel of land for a proper price of 100 pieces of silver. But instead of living within the city walls itself, Yaakov pitches tents well outside the city walls. Remember, he was a shepherd, but living near the city, well, it offers some security and protection for his family, and it also provides the convenience of having all the necessary staples nearby. The amount that he paid for the land outside the city was also important, because it records that he did purchase the land, and that he paid a proper price for it, so he couldn't be accused of cheating the king. Now, this is reminiscent of that time when Abraham purchased the cave of Machpelah as a burial grounds for his wife, Sarah, where every element of proof of purchase without dispute was provided. So these arrangements would prove to be very important for a future time. If you fast forward to Genesis 48, this particular piece of land was willed to Yaakov to his son Yosef, and Yosef was buried there after the Exodus as the Israelites carried his bones with them. Before we close, just one more significant note about this special place. If you have your Bible handy, you could turn to John chapter 4, verse 1 to 14. Once again, John chapter 4, verses 1 to 14. And we'll look over the story where Yeshua demonstrates a very important principle. At this moment in history, Shechem was going by the name Sychar, but they are one and the same. Here at the very well that Yaakov dug to provide water for his family and his animals, we actually find Yeshua's encounter with the Samaritan woman. And it's interesting, isn't it, that the first non-Jewish person to be offered a drink of the living water that brings everlasting life was, one, a woman, and two, a hated Samaritan. It occurred at the very first place Yaakov, Yisrael, settled when he came back into the Promised Land from Mesopotamia. Today, Shechem is in the West Bank and goes by the Arab name of Nablus. The Palestinians claim that they have always held this land. And here Yaakov, now called Israel, he felt that he had come to this place that would likely be his clan's permanent home. So he erects an altar and called it El Elohe Yisrael. These Hebrew words mean El, the highest God of Israel. By naming it this, he was declaring that he worshipped the Mighty One, and he incorporated his own new name, Israel, perhaps foreshadowing its use for the nation of Israel, which at this point consisted only of Yaakov's extended household. And they wouldn't be staying here long, though. And that just about wraps up this week's study. Please take time to review and observe these three chapters more closely. Are there any patterns of God that you see emerging through the text? What themes stand out to you as you read? You know, as we're still on COVID restrictions here in Toronto, I'd like to encourage you to connect with your own Access Church communities and study these lessons from Genesis together. Take time to discuss the lessons that God is teaching you through your study of the scriptures. Pray together and encourage one another in this faith journey. Friends, thank you so much for joining us for today's Access Learn study. As always, it's such a joy to be able to get around God's Word and learn more about His plan and His purposes, and about His amazing love and His promises. I'm so excited to see where He'll lead us next. May the grace of our Lord Yeshua and the shalom of God our Father be with all.
I believe in life eternal. I believe in the virgin birth. I believe in the saints' communion and in your holy church. I believe.